to Ayatollah Sistani, let's take a listen to a short biography about him.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hausa lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzumah Sabzawari and Sharh Ishraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazvini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in fiqh and usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Sheikh Sobhit, since we are talking about the laws, Islamic laws related to gambling, according to Ayatollah Sistani's position, what is his position or Islamic law about football, playing tennis, for example, cricket, volleyball, basketball, and the likes? Is it permissible to play them, even if concerning the fact that both teams or clubs play or compete against each other for a prize? So there is a prize.
Yes.
All right. Yeah. Maybe they don't bet.
Yes.
All right. But there is a prize. So there is a money, there is a cup, there is something that they play over.
Yes.
So is it permissible to play against such groups or teams or clubs?
And do you mean that there is a kind of betting?
Well, there is a cup, there is a prize. Yes. Is it haram per se? Is it unlawful? Or it's permissible?
Well, generally speaking, these matches that are, you see, held here and there, and we see these matches on TV screens, they are played and they are sponsored usually by a federation or a country, you see. And it's these are international matches that are held here and there.
Mm-hmm.
One country plays against another country, and there is, for example, FIFA, or there is, for example, an international organization or an international body that sponsors these matches. And of course, the prize is given by these federations or these countries. It's not the individual.
Globally or locally?
Yeah, globally or locally, as you said. And of course, it's not the individual who either wins or loses, who either wins the prize or maybe loses something in terms of monetary value.
Yes.
Both parties to the match do not lose or win anything of monetary value.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they compete for the title. They compete for the prize, and the prize is not given by the loser. It's given by an organization that sponsors the match.
Mm-hmm.
The match is held with the cooperation and under the supervision of a team or a league, of course. And according to Ayatollah Sistani, there is no problem whatsoever in playing football, tennis, cricket, and these international matches. games, of course.
I see. But as long as there is a sponsor,
yes,
outside of the teams of and the members team. Of the team,
sure,
right?
Yes.
But what if the team members or the club members,
that's not permissible,
put their money there? Like in some local tournaments, I've seen it myself, the team members have to pay a special share,
mm-hmm,
so that this money is collected and raised together and becomes something big,
yes,
like of, you know, high value, and then they buy, for example, a cup or something as a kind of prize, and then they put it there and they play against each other for that, or in order to win that cup.
Win that cup.
All right. So is it permissible? Because it's not sponsored by a third party, an observer.
Yes.
All right. Everybody who's involved has to pay a special share.
Well, if that is the case, Ayatollah Sistani says it's a matter of objection. It's a matter of objection. It is problematic, and that means we should not put money together. Okay, it's a kind of pool. I don't know if I'm right in using this term.
Mm-hmm.
They put their money together, and
yes,
then at the end of the match, the winner picks up the money and goes away home. Okay,
like a trust.
No, that's not permissible, because it's a kind of betting. And of course it is betting, because either side wins or loses.
Yes.
So the one that suffers the loss, he has to pay out of his pocket.
Yes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore it's not permissible, because it's a kind of betting. It's no different from betting. But imagine you play table tennis.
Yes.
And there are two people playing table tennis. What is the difference between playing table tennis and also playing backgammon or card game or and the likes of such games, okay?
Yes.
It's if the two sides put money together and then, mm-hmm, they fight for that money, it's another name. It's,
yes,
another. It's tantamount to kind of to
gambling.
Betting,
yes,
or gambling.
Yes.
So, but if this tournament is held by an organization, or let's say a sponsoring body, like a federation,
mm-hmm,
then there is no problem, because that third person, which is not involved in the game, it's not playing directly,
mm-hmm,
and it's just actually supervising and managing the game, that third party is giving the money, there is no problem.
I see.
As long as they give the money with their consent, of course.
Mm-hmm.
The office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
What about casinos, and especially opening a casino? Is it permissible?
Oh, casinos are places for gambling.
Yes.
You know? It's absolutely forbidden, according to Ayatollah Sistani, to inaugurate or to open a place for gambling. It's absolutely forbidden to do anything which promotes gambling. Anything which promotes gambling, whether you are acting in a film, or you are opening a space, providing a space for gambling, or you are doing something, contributing to it, it's absolutely forbidden. And it's not permissible under any circumstances to open a casino.
Mm-hmm.
let alone playing, or maybe even it's not permissible for a Muslim to go in to enter a casino, okay? No. Let alone opening it, let alone supporting it, or let's say financing such a building, running such a building. It's not permissible. You know, when it comes to a Muslim going into a casino, it's kind of degrading for a Muslim. It is humiliating for a Muslim. For a Muslim mm-hmm. who is dignified, who is in the eye of Sharia, whose respect is must be upheld,
mm-hmm.
it is actually degrading for a Muslim to go to a casino and to stay there, to watch there, even if he's not playing. He's not playing any kind of games in that in the casino, but he's going into that casino is disrespectful. It is degrading and it is humiliating for him. So it's not permissible for a Muslim to humiliate himself, to do something that brings him down in the eye of the common people.
So is it quite related to this question, in fact, the previous one? Is it impermissible to engage in any kind of business or activity involving, gambling tools, gambling itself, and also musical instruments?
Of course, it's clearly stated in our books, in our fiqh books, in our fiqh literature,
mm-hmm.
and our sources, religious sources, that earning through these means is forbidden. It could be gambling, it could be musical instruments,
mm-hmm.
or it could be singing, it could be dancing. Any of these things are, all of these things are forbidden, and it's not permissible to earn by doing any of these things, because these are haram sources, and it's not permissible under any circumstances to gamble and to earn your livelihood by gambling. To play music, haram kind of music, and earn your livelihood by playing that music, or to take part in a lahv, or in a kind of amusement, in a kind of entertainment, and earn your livelihood, or to earn your livelihood by selling these instruments, mm-hmm. instruments of gambling, like chessboard. You want to sell chessboard, and you want to keep selling chessboard and run your life by mm-hmm. selling these chessboards. Or to run your life by selling musical instruments. All of these are sources of haram means. They're sources of haram income.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it's not permissible to earn through these sources.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javed. That was the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Rahman Rahim Mannan Kareem Salam Aleem La ilaha illahum Ghaffar Jameel Wahhab Latif Tawwab Sami'un Basir
Summits like Davos in the desert, held in Riyadh in October 2019, was in fact the kingdom's desperate effort to lure foreign investors. But the stakes are high in the kingdom, where the royal family is still above the law. Any legal dispute with Al Saud princes may put a businessman's trade and life in ruins.
This is exactly what happened to Gary Arnold, a British entrepreneur who introduced English fish and chips to Saudi Arabia.
حادث الحدث مؤلم جدا لجميع السعوديين.
Gary Arnold, 50, was arrested in Dubai in October. He is now languishing in a police cell without access to his phone. He's facing 8 charges for unpaid debts from creditors to his company, including one that carries a maximum 2-year jail sentence. And this is not what the young Gary hoped when he went to Riyadh some 20 years ago. Arnold launched his fish and chip business in 2000 under the name of London Business Group, growing it to 36 branches in malls across Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and elsewhere in the Middle East. In 2017, the Saudi's royal family company, Harbor Holdings Hima Foods, decided to buy out Arnold's successful business under a deal valued at about 30 million riyals, or 7 million pounds. Arnold should have received 6 million riyals as an existing partner, but the merged business struggled to meet its liabilities without the Saudi cash injection, culminating in March 2018 with Arnold's arrest and detention for 5 days in UAE for a missed payment on a bank loan. His passport was then confiscated and he got a 2-year sentence in absentia.
You have to have confidence in the rule of law. You have to have confidence that there's consistency and there's justice underpinning the country, and no investor in their right mind would dare take a chance of rolling a dice in entering an environment where that does not exist, or it only exists in the breach. And it seems to me that Saudi Arabia is run by diktat, at the whims and fancies of these Saudi princes, and that the law is there to serve their whims, not there to constrain or restrain their excesses. And, investors require confidence, they require stability, and Saudi Arabia lacks all of the above.
Arnold's ensuing legal dispute pitted him against a high-profile family of Saudi royals, central to which is Prince Faisal bin Bandar bin Sultan bin Abdulaziz Al Saud, the current chairman of Harbor Holdings. 2 other royals linked to the company are its ex-chairman, Prince Khalid bin Bandar Al Saud, Saudi ambassador to London, and its co-founder, Princess Rima bin Bandar Al Saud, the Saudi ambassador to Washington.
Well, very little. These princes, as I say, lord over the country. The country is buttressed by 2 extremes: extreme decadence and ostentation on the part of the royal family at one end, and extreme religious sectarianism and medieval barbarism at the hands of the Wahhabi religious apparatus at the other end. And in between, you have people being squeezed as in a vice. And so in such a scenario, you are playing with fire when you enter the legal system there. I don't think it's a legal system. I think it's more a system of brutality that comes with the patina of legality. And as I say, this will send every right-thinking foreign investor running for cover rather than invest in such a country.
According to Arnold's lawyer, Toby Cadman, London Business Group was a very successful business that the Saudi Arabian Royals Company has destroyed through negligence or incompetence. Before his arrest, Gary Arnold had an interview with The Telegraph about his now miserable situation, which shed light on what the Saudis would like to hide behind their glitzy summits. This is Arnold's experience after 20 years of working in Saudi Arabia and interacting with the royal family. These are high-profile individuals who seem to be under the impression that they can dump their responsibilities and ignore our exposure. I have been shouldering their liabilities for the last 3 years. Despite numerous promises, both written and verbal, they haven't met their responsibilities. It has left us without a business and without an income. It has left us trapped in a country which we no longer want to be part of,
and separated from our family and loved ones. I have had to send my family back to London and am unable to pay the school fees and my housing costs. My residency visa has expired, and the Saudis continue to say they're going to pay, then don't, which is unacceptable.
This development, the plight of Gary Arnold, will send a chill down the spine of every putative investor into Saudi Arabia. And it only confirms that even though the country or the state has made a great boast of modernizing under the rule of Prince bin Salman, it's only modernizing its illegality, modernizing its corruption, and modernizing the arbitrariness of rule by diktat by various Saudi princes, of which there are a great number. And so I think this is going to be a wake-up call for the international investment community when it comes to their dealings with Saudi Arabia. This is just further evidence that Saudi Arabia is less a state and more a vast criminal enterprise masquerading as one.
The money still failed to materialize despite personal commitment to proceed with the deal with Prince Faisal in June 2018, in which he acknowledged some financial circumstances have happened which prevented him from transferring the shares and paying the remaining amount. Now, Katman is trying to put pressure on the royals to pay the money they owe the businessman. But according to him, it is going to cost Mr. Arnold and his business partner tens of thousands of pounds, all of which has been caused by the Saudis. The failure of the Saudi royals company to keep its part of the deal has left Gary Arnold facing financial ruin, a jail sentence, and reposition of his home for unpaid debts, as well as being separated from his family and unable to return to the UK due to the confiscation of his passport.
I just think that we have reached the end game when it comes to Saudi Arabia. We should have reached this point after the vile murder by Bonesaw of Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul a couple of years ago. But the Trump regime covered that up because money talks, and money in the West is seen as more important than human life. But there are increasing clamour amongst people, increasing awakening as to the character of Saudi Arabia. And despite the attempt at sports washing, holding like big boxing events and other sporting events in Saudi Arabia, I think the rot is set in. Saudi Arabia is trying to win the favour of Western investors, businessmen, corporations. It wants to replicate what's going on in Dubai, but I don't think it will be possible to do that because of the character of the state, a state born in blood, nourished by blood, and which feasts on the blood of innocents in its own country and in the region.
The question is if the story of Gary Arnold is due to the misconduct of some bad apples in the Saudi royal family, or it is part of the game in the authoritarian kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Isn't Arnold's story somehow similar to the Ritz-Carlton arrest story, where hundreds of Saudi businessmen were arrested and tortured before their properties being confiscated?
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. Thank you.
on the news line.
A mega free trade pact came into existence a few days ago. The Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership has been described as the largest free trade agreement in history. 10 Southeast Asian countries, as well as China, South Korea, Japan, Australia, and New Zealand, formed a brand new trading bloc. The agreement was signed on the sidelines of the annual meeting of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations on Sunday, after nearly a decade of negotiations. What makes the RCEP very important is its sheer size, nearly a third of global economy. The world's largest trading bloc has become a reality as the international community is grappling with the devastating economic impact of the coronavirus pandemic. It is hoped that the RCEP will spur economic recovery from the downturn caused by the virus. Meanwhile, the new agreement, which excludes the United States, is widely viewed as a geopolitical victory for the world's second largest economy, China. Observers believe it will boost China's influence in the region at a time when the U.S. is taking a tough line on its arch economic rival.
I can't emphasize enough how important the free trade agreement is for the reshaping of international political and economic relationships. And this will clearly strengthen China's hand in trying to keep the United States from its somewhat hostile incursions into what the Chinese government considers its territories.
The RCEP is described by some experts as a major win for multilateralism and free trade, despite America's withdrawal from many international agreements. The new free trade agreement is often compared to the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal that U.S. President Donald Trump defiantly tore apart soon after he took office. The administration of U.S. President Donald Trump has been particularly confrontational in its economic strategy. The White House has implemented protectionist policies like no other U.S. administration. It has taken a tough line on China, blaming it for a large part of America's trade deficit. The U.S. has also engaged in trade conflicts with other major players like the European Union. But Trump's protectionist agenda is not preventing the rest of the world from pursuing free trade at different levels. The Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership is proof that the world prefers multilateralism.
That will give extraordinary support to the multilateralization of international trade in a way that perhaps is not contemplated in the concept of bipolarity or even in the notion of globalization as it was being considered in recent years.
Even America's close allies like the EU are engaged in free trade negotiations. Trump's protectionist agenda may eventually backfire because as a growing number of countries sign free trade deals, American exporters may soon find themselves losing ground to international competitors. But who knows what direction America will take in the future? Trump will probably have to leave the White House in January, and that does not give him enough time to complete his America First project. The projected winner of the U.S. presidential election, Joe Biden, will face many dilemmas exactly because of Trump's controversial policies. Biden's presidency will probably mean a more traditional U.S. role on the world stage. He could bring back America from the brink of a full-blown trade and military conflict with China. But he cannot abruptly do away with Trump's protectionism to join free trade deals. Because right now, many Americans would see any such decision as throwing away U.S. jobs.
Top Iraqi military officials, including Defense Minister Lieutenant General Juma Anatsadun Khattab, along with the Navy, Air Force, and Air Defense commanders, have visited the Iranian capital, Tehran, and met with high-ranking officials there. Chairman of the Chiefs of Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Bagheri, said the two sides discussed ways to reinforce defense and military cooperation. Bagheri further noted that during his meeting with the Iraqi defense minister, the two sides exchanged views on issues related to defense industry and security of the two countries' common borders, as well as bilateral cooperation and joint military exercises. The Iranian officials stressed the significance of boosting defense cooperation between the two neighbors, as the United States is after redeploying terrorists in the region.
A resurgence of terrorism in the region will help the United States to maintain its influence and to even infiltrate more than before in the region. And who is milking terrorist groups in the region in order to impose its will, in order to occupy, plunder, and change regimes?
The Iraqi defense chief also held talks with Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, on bilateral, regional, and international developments. Shamkhani said a U.S. objective is to create rifts and conflicts among regional states in West Asia, underlining the need for the regional countries to exercise vigilance against the sinister plot. Khattab, for his part, hailed Tehran's support and assistance for his country in repelling terrorism and stressed expanding bilateral relations, especially in military and security sectors. Calls for the ouster of foreign troops from the Iraqi soil strengthened following the U.S. assassination of top Iranian anti-terror commander Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and deputy head of Iraq's popular mobilization units Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis near the Baghdad airport earlier this year. Following the attack, Iraqi lawmakers unanimously approved a bill demanding the withdrawal of all foreign forces from the country. Numerous rallies and protests have also been held across the country since with the same demands. The latest such demonstration was held last week near Baghdad's high-security green zone, where government buildings and foreign missions, including the U.S. Embassy, are located.
By assassinating the Iranian and Iraqi anti-terror heroes who literally liberated Iraq and Syria from the terrors of ISIS, the United States was fighting against the fight on terrors. And how could they sell their weapons, warmongers in the United States sell their weapons and maintain their presence?
Washington has so far transferred several Iraqi military bases back to local forces, with senior U.S. military officials saying local forces are increasingly able to counter terrorism on their own. The head of the Pentagon's Central Command said earlier this year that the number of U.S. troops in West Asia, including Iraq and Syria, would most likely be reduced soon. The commander, however, said he expected U.S. and NATO forces to maintain a long-term presence in Iraq to both help what he called fighting terrorism and checking Iranian influence in the country.
People have suffered enough, and in fact, they have demanded the United States presence termination. I think if the Iraqi government believes that they have democracy, that they have a system that can translate public opinion into laws and normatives, they should facilitate what the Iraqi parliament has already ratified.
But what has prompted the United States to reduce its troops in the region? Some experts say Trump wants to deliver his 2016 campaign promise of bringing back American forces from abroad. But others believe that Washington is losing its footprint in West Asia as calls for expelling U.S. forces by regional nations have grown stronger than ever. Top Iraqi military officials, including Defense Minister Lieutenant General Juma Anatsadun Khattab, along with the Navy, Air Force, and Air Defense commanders, have visited the Iranian capital, Tehran, and met with high-ranking officials there. Chairman of the Chiefs of Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Bagheri, said the two sides discussed ways to reinforce defense and military cooperation. Bagheri further noted that during his meeting with the Iraqi defense minister, the two sides exchanged views on issues related to defense industry and security of the two countries' common borders, as well as bilateral cooperation and joint military exercises. The Iranian officials stressed the significance of boosting defense cooperation between the two neighbors, as the United States is after redeploying terrorists in the region.
A resurgence of terrorism in the region will help the United States to maintain its influence and to even infiltrate more than before in the region. And who is milking terrorist groups in the region in order to impose its will, in order to occupy, plunder, and change regimes?
The Iraqi defense chief also held talks with Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, on bilateral, regional, and international developments. Shamkhani said the U.S. objective is to create rifts and conflicts among regional states in West Asia, underlining the need for the regional countries to exercise vigilance against the sinister plot. Khattab, for his part, hailed Tehran's support and assistance for his country in repelling terrorism and stressed expanding bilateral relations, especially in military and security sectors. Calls for the ouster of foreign troops from the Iraqi soil strengthened following the U.S. assassination of top Iranian anti-terror commander Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and deputy head of Iraq's popular mobilization units Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis near the Baghdad airport earlier this year. Following the attack, Iraqi lawmakers unanimously approved a bill demanding the withdrawal of all foreign forces from the country. Numerous rallies and protests have also been held across the country since with the same demands. The latest such demonstration was held last week near Baghdad's high-security green zone, where government buildings and foreign missions, including the U.S. embassy, are located.
By assassinating the Iranian and Iraqi anti-terror heroes who literally liberated Iraq and Syria from the terrors of ISIS, the United States was fighting against the fight on terrors. And how could they sell their weapons, warmongers in the United States sell their weapons and maintain their presence?
Washington has so far transferred several Iraqi military bases back to local forces, with senior U.S. military officials saying local forces are increasingly able to counter terrorism on their own. The head of the Pentagon's Central Command said earlier this year that the number of U.S. troops in West Asia, including Iraq and Syria, would most likely be reduced soon. The commander, however, said he expected U.S. and NATO forces to maintain a long-term presence in Iraq to both help what he called fighting terrorism and checking Iranian influence in the country.
People have suffered enough, and in fact, they have demanded the United States presence termination. I think if the Iraqi government believes that they have democracy, that they have a system that can translate public opinion into laws and normatives, they should facilitate what the Iraqi parliament has already ratified.
But what has prompted the United States to reduce its troops in the region? Some experts say Trump wants to deliver his 2016 campaign promise of bringing back American forces from abroad. But others believe that Washington is losing its footprint in West Asia as calls for expelling U.S. forces by regional nations have grown stronger than ever.
Not so long ago, the Prime Minister of Ethiopia was stood on the stage at the Nobel Hall in Oslo, receiving the Nobel Peace Prize for his efforts in achieving peace and international cooperation in resolving the border dispute with neighbouring country, Eritrea. Move forward to today, and the Ethiopian Prime Minister is refusing to enter any form of dialogue over an ongoing ethnic conflict in the north of the country, with some allegations now suggesting that war crimes could be being committed in the region as the battle rages on between the Ethiopian military and the Tigray People's Liberation Front. The United Nations lead on human rights, Michelle Bachelet, has stated that the situation is spinning out of control, leading to heavy casualties, destruction, and mass displacement of people, something that the region is very much ill-equipped to cope with, leading to a potential humanitarian disaster. But for the Nobel Peace Prize winner, Ahmed Arbery, he's making very serious claims that the Tigray people are responsible for acts of treason and terrorism, something that has seen the conflict see the Ethiopian military step up their efforts in sending resources to the region to quash the notion. Yet it seems that the scale of the operation is causing disturbing reports emerging from the area, with witnesses claiming that they've seen Ethiopian forces bombing civilian areas, as well as ground operations that have seen shooting on the streets, as well as machete attacks. So what is the real source of this conflict, and why have tensions escalated into a full-blown civil war, in spite of pleas by the international arena to halt the fighting?
When the current Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed came to power in 2018, he decided that he was now going to eliminate this old structure, and he proposed a new party called the Prosperity Party, which would not be based on any nationality, not Tigrayan, not Oromo, not Amhara, etc. And the TPLF rebelled and didn't want their power challenged with this new structure.
What now remains to be seen is whether the fighting will cause the conflict to spill over into neighboring countries, something that could lead to further issues in the region. Ethiopia is no stranger when it comes to seeing masses of people flee from its nation. The 1980s saw famine force hundreds of thousands of Ethiopians away from their homeland in search of food and water. And yet again today, the same dilemma is in force, yet this time with people fleeing conflict. Estimates have already placed over 14,500 people, half of whom are children, as fleeing the conflict zone, with many of them heading to Sudan, with aid agencies stating that more could follow as the situation becomes worse. With the tensions now spreading outside of the Tigray region in the form of an attack on an airport in the neighbouring state, the notion that refugees could start abandoning Ethiopia from other parts of the country could have a detrimental effect on the region and could draw in the presence of neighbouring countries into the fold. Yet as the conflict escalates and no sign of diplomacy is on the immediate horizon, the situation in and around the Horn of Africa could escalate into a regional war as neighbouring states and international actors form alliances and allegiances based on their own goals, setting off yet another disaster in a region that should instead be embracing a post-colonial peace.
Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us a sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah.
You are our true God.
To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters, all over the world, assalamu alaikum and welcome to The Last Savior and our discussion concerning the dreams of those who dream to be the Imam of the age or to claim to be the Imam of the age and its validity and reliability. We have actually historically talked and analyzed those people who claim to be Mahdi based on the dreams, and we talked about the reliability and validity of a dream for a person to be known as Mahdi, and then we mentioned those sects and their followers and the leaders of these sects, and we reached to our current time, I think, after Ahmadiyya, or which was created by Qadiani. I think now we are going to discuss those who claim to be Mahdi after Ahmadiyya sect, and this is what we shall continue, and with presence of Islamic thinker and researcher, Sheikh Murtada Kalmi from Qom Seminary Schools. Sheikh Murtada, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam and thank you for having me.
Thanks for accepting the invitation. It's true that the prophethood or imamate of an imam or a prophet has not been based on a dream. But what can we say for the story of Yusuf? Even these false claimants might say that, Sheikh, we have already dreamed it earlier before we become an imam. We have dreamed it and it was a royal sadaqah then. It was a true dream. Then how can it be answered?
Yeah. When Prophet Ya'qub alayhi salam says that وَكَذَلِكَ يَجْتَبِيكَ رَبُّكَ, this is how your Lord will choose you, it doesn't mean that at that time. The verb which is used is mudara in Arabic language, which can happen in the future. So Prophet Ya'qub alayhi salam here is telling Yusuf that وَكَذَلِكَ يَجْتَبِيكَ رَبُّكَ, in the future you will be chosen as a prophet, not now. Now, regarding your question, first of all, these false claimants, they resort to the dreams to prove that they are the prophet, they are the imam or the deputies of the imam. In our case, Yusuf alayhi salam, he's not resorting to the dream to tell the people that I am the prophet. Mm-hmm. He sees in a dream and then we have the interpretation of the dream. But is this dream a way of people to know the prophet? This is not the case. Mm-hmm. I mean, Prophet Yusuf alayhi salam, neither him nor his father, they do not tell the people that you have to believe in Yusuf alayhi salam as the prophet because he saw 11 planets and the sun and the moon and so on and so forth.
It was used just as a sign.
Yeah, but these false claimants,
they want to base their imamate.
Exactly.
As
they tell the people that you see in a dream and in the dream you are told that we are the imams or the deputies of the imam. And the next point and the last point about the story of Prophet Yusuf alayhi salam is that according to some scholars, it is a possible meaning that وَكَذَلِكَ يَجْتَبِيكَ رَبُّكَ, it doesn't refer to the prophethood of Prophet Yusuf alayhi salam. Mm-hmm. The verse is telling us that you will be chosen by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, but it might refer to the fact that later he was chosen as the king of Egypt. So the verse does not talk about prophethood of Prophet Yusuf alayhi salam. It only says وَكَذَلِكَ يَجْتَبِيكَ رَبُّكَ. And at least there is a possibility that it is referring to the kingdom of Yusuf alayhi salam, which has nothing to do with his prophethood.
Very true. So even if it is used even for one single prophet, I think it can be understood that it was not the sunnah of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to use it for all the prophets.
That's true. But of course, you want proof that even in this case, this is not the case.
Yeah.
For people, dream is not a way to establish and prove the prophethood of Prophet Yusuf alayhi salam.
And now, Sheikh, how can we expose to some narrations that they actually mention that the ru'ya or the dream of a mu'min at the end of the time, akhir zaman, is a proof? There are some narrations that they claim such a thing. And some of these narrations can be actually defended to be a valid or authentic hadith. So can these people refer to this types of riwayat and narrations to prove their ru'ya?
Yes, we have a few narrations, and the followers of these false claimants, they have resorted to these narrations to tell the people that dream is a way to know the imam of your time or then to know the deputy of an imam. One of them is a narration from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, also narrated by Sheikh Kolaini in Al-Kafi, volume 8, page 90. In this narration, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, رَأْيُ الْمُؤْمِنِ وَرُؤْيَاهُ فِي آخِرِ الزَّمَانِ عَلَى سَبْعِينَ جُزْءًا مِنْ أَجْزَاءِ النُّبُوَّةِ. This is one of the famous narrations that they refer to.
True.
And we want to analyze this narration. In this narration, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says that in the end of the time, in Akhir al-Zaman, two things, Ra'yul Mu'min, the viewpoints, the opinion of a believer, and Ru'ya, his dreams, are like and tantamount 70 parts of the prophethood.
Do you mean that Imam wanted these two things to be together, his viewpoints and Ru'ya together, or no?
No, Imam wants to say that the opinion of a believer is true, and the dream of a believer is true in Akhirat Zaman.
How come we see that the opinions of some believers are not true these set days?
Yeah,
that's the point. Inshallah, we want to analyze this narration and to come to know what Imam Sadiq alayhi salam is exactly talking about. So according to this narration, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam is telling us that the dream of a believer is like a part of prophethood, mm-hmm. which means that the dream of a believer is necessarily true. Now the first point is the word al-mu'min in the narration.
Yeah.
A believer. Now, I think all the listeners agree that we cannot say that whoever claims that I am a Muslim, I am a believer, I am a mu'min, mm-hmm. He is a true mu'min as mentioned by Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam. When a person is given such a high status that his dream and his opinions are like those of the prophets, we know that this is not, I mean, the regular believers. Mm-hmm. He's the, I mean, in the highest rank of a believer. So, because we can think of nowadays the followers of different groups, they claim that all of us, we are believers, we are
and mu'min. The mu'min, a real mu'min, was actually explained and described in the hadith.
That's
that
true.
It has some stages exactly. to reach the level of iman. So with this definition, very few of people will exactly. be actually included in
yeah,
that
the
circle.
Point is that nowadays the followers of Ahmed Ismail, they say that we are believers, our dreams are true. The followers of Haydar Mushattad, another claimant who rejects Ahmed Ismail, they also say that we are believers.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is that their dreams are contradicting each other. So this is the first point.
Wherever you be, I'll be with you, 'cause you're the one my heart is to meet you.
Now the conclusion is that the mu'min, the believer, which is mentioned in this narration, is a mu'min who is in such a high rank that always his dreams are true. And in another narration, instead of this word, we have إِنَّ الرُّؤْيَا صَادِقَ جُزْءٌ مِنْ سَبْعِينَ جُزْءًا مِنَ النُّبُوَّةِ. The true dream is one part out of 70 parts of prophethood. When we put together these two narrations, the conclusion is that only the dreams of a believer are true, whose dreams always are true. Ruya Sadiqa mm-hmm. are true.
And this cannot be seen in any person except imams.
Yeah, that's the point. Or very, very close companions of the of
very
imams,
close
which are very
yeah.
close to that high rank of the imams as well. So the conclusion from this part of the explanation is that the true dreams of such people are true. And the other point is that the word ru'ya has been mentioned in this narration. And as some scholars believe, the word ru'ya in the Quran has been used only for the true dreams.
Very true.
A false dream is not called a ru'ya in the Noble Book of Quran. Now, the next point, which is also worthy of contemplation, is that we ask the followers of one of these false claimants, for example, let's say Ahmed Ismail, who refers to a dream as one of the ways to prove his ideas, that which type of dreams do you resort to? The dreams that you saw before you believe in Ahmed, or the dreams that you see after believing in him?
Mm-hmm.
This is a very interesting argument.
Yeah.
If you say that the dreams that we saw before we believe in Ahmed Ismail, our answer is that in that case you are not a mu'min, because you did not believe in Ahmed al-Hassan as you have to. So according to your claim, Ahmed al-Hassan is the imam and you have to believe in him. So if you see a dream before believing in Ahmed Ismail, you cannot resort to this narration, because this narration is telling us that the dream of a true mu'min is a part of prophethood. But before believing in Ahmed al-Hassan, according to yourself, you were not a real and a true believer. My point is that before he see this dream, Ahmed al-Hassan claimed his ideas. I mean, for many years, he's inviting the people.
Okay, me living, for example, in Europe, I have dreamed Ahmed Ismail, Ahmed al-Hassan, when the time that I did not know anything about him.
I found him in my dreams, and there is a person who will emerge in Basra, and his name is blah blah, and you need to follow him. Then is it quite clear for me or not?
The point is that we are discussing and explaining this narration. This narration says that Ra'yul Mu'min wa ru'yahu fi akhir al-zaman ala sab'ina juz'an min ajza'in nubuwwah. The dream of a believer in akhir al-zaman, let's say, is a true dream. Before I believe in Ahmad al-Hassan, I'm not the Mu'min which is described in this narration, according to the followers of Ahmad al-Hassan. If Ahmad al-Hassan is the Imam and he's the deputy of the Imam, then I have to believe in him.
True.
Before I believe in him, I cannot be called al-Mu'min as mentioned in the narration. The narration says that the dream of a Mu'min is true. Before I believe in Ahmad al-Hassan, I'm not a Mu'min, according to the followers of Ahmad Ismail. I'm not a true Mu'min. I have to believe in Ahmad al-Hassan
first,
then,
to become Mu'min first.
Then I am a believer.
So in their own understanding,
we are actually
interpreting this word.
That which type of dream do you want to resort to? Before you believe in him, you are not a Mu'min, so your dreams is not an argument. And if you say that, no, the dreams that we saw after we believed in him, this is what we call it door in logic. You cannot, first of all, believe in a person and then see a dream to prove him as the Imam.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Murtada, for your beautiful explanations, and your respected listeners for staying tuned with this discussion. Actually, we have discussed that in the continuation of our discussion concerning the validity and reliability of dreams to prove the imamate of a person at the end of the time, akhir zaman. We said that the dreams no way can prove the imamate of an imam. For those who refer to the story of Yusuf, the prophet, and Quranic verse that says that Yusuf actually dreamed his prophethood in his early ages, you want to say that yes, he dreamed it, but he through this dream he did not want to prove his prophethood. So it is a quite different story, and no person, no imam and no prophet needs the dreams to prove his imamate or prophethood. Rather, this is against the sunnah of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Allah wants people to believe in his prophets and imams based on clear-cut and quite evident proofs for everyone, so that he completes the proof on the people of the earth. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala include us among the real followers of the school of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, and the real followers of Imam of the time, Mahdi alayhi as-salam, and among the genuine waiters of the Imam of the time, Imam Mahdi alayhi as-salam. Till our next session, I'd like to invite you to join us with the upcoming discussion that we shall have again on the issues of Mahdawiyya and Mahdism. I leave in Allah's protection. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. O Allah, protect your representative, Al-Hujjab bin al-Hassan, Imam al-Mahdi, and send salutation upon him and his ancestors, now as well as all the times. Be his guardian, protector, guide, and assistance. Help him in his path and be watchful for him till you let him rule over the earth willingly and cause him to live in it for a long time.
IRIB English Radio.